You're listening to a Thames Estuary Partnership podcast, celebrating London's famous tidal river. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Talk of the Thames. I'm your host, Chloe Russell, and on today's episode, I'll be chatting with Alison Denby. Alison's the Senior Conservation Programme Manager at Zoological Society of London, and in today's episode, we'll be talking about the State of the Thames report. I hope you enjoy listening. Welcome, Alison. It's so great to have you here for another episode of Talk of the Thames. Thank you so much for being here. And how are you today?
Oh, I'm all good, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Always love talking about the Thames.
Fantastic. To just get us up to grips and everybody knows whereabouts we are, we know that you work at ZSL, which is short for Zoological Society of London. Can you just give us an overview of what you do there and what ZSL is in general?
Sure. So ZSL is a conservation charity, and we've been working around the world for over 200 years. We're an old learned society for the conservation of wildlife, but always in the context of people. So I'm a senior conservation program manager there, and I head up the estuaries and wetlands team, where we focus a lot on wetland restoration. And by wetlands, we mean the rivers through to the estuaries, often forgotten, like our beautiful Thames, and out to the coastal areas and the sea. So I have a team of marine biologists and river biologists who are out there working in partnership with communities and government and other stakeholders to basically restore, repair our aquatic environment, so heavily used, but for the benefit of people as well as wildlife.
That's brilliant. Thank you. And today we have you talking about the State of the Thames report, which is exciting. It's the first one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a first one. And yeah, it's, well, I can tell you a bit about why we wanted to do it, if that's
of interest. Yeah. Well, how did it come about, and why is it important, and why is this the first report? Why now?
I know. Well, it took us a little while to produce because we're having to pull all the data together. But when we set out, it was 60 years since the Natural History Museum had issued a report stating that parts of the river were biologically dead. So back in the 1950s, the river had got once more so badly polluted that it was effectively devoid of life in many stretches. And that means there was such pollution in there, it took all the oxygen out and nothing really could live in it. So we really wanted to see how far we'd come since that point. So it was 60 years on from that. And we wanted to benchmark, because we're busy telling everyone how, you know, how wonderful it is. And it is, what an amazing wildlife habitat, so important. But we just wanted to see how long we were, or how far we were on the journey to recovery. And being the Zoological Society of London, ZSL, we really wanted to focus on more the environmental constraints, so what was in the river, so the chemical and the physical, but also the biological condition of it. So really focusing on the state of the environment in the water and the state of, I guess, how the animals interacted with those that depend on it.
Mm. What was the process, the data collection, and did it take a really long time to write up?
It took quite a long time. The process, I mean, it was very much a collaborative effort. So we were, I guess, ringmasters, but where the data are owned and collected by many, many stakeholders across London and across nationally. You know, primarily the Environment Agency collect and monitor a lot of the environmental conditions, so they hold the data. But other partner organisations, such as the Thames Estuary Partnership or Thames 21, also hold a lot of data. So we really sort of worked with these, our colleagues amongst these organisations, to pull the data together and have it in one place. And sort of we were lucky enough to secure funding from the Royal Bank of Canada to have staff time devoted to analysing the data and really drawing out the trends in it. So it was very much a collective effort. It took us, 2 years in the end to get there, but hopefully it'll give us a really strong baseline and foundation and benchmark to be able to repeat the process, you know, every few years to see the area, you know, how we're getting on. We established 17 indicators going across state of the environment, state of nature, and state of play. So the physical, the social, and the environmental, ecological more, I guess. And we hope that then we can drill down and see, you know, we can target actions in those or any of the ones that are seeing negative trends to change that. And hopefully it will really focus our work, our collective work, so working together to improve the state of the river.
That's great. Yeah, that's really good. Do you oversee the three parts of the report, the state of play, state of the environment, and what was the other one? I wrote it down. You're having a look as well.
State of the environment. I lived and breathed this running report, and I'm blanked out of my brain, probably scarred. State of nature, state of play, state of the environment. No, it's a great sense of achievement to do it.
Yeah, mega.
Yeah, so I did oversee it, but one of my team members, Hannah McCormack, did an awful lot of the work, and we work closely with our Institute of Zoology, which is a conservation biology research institute, one of the leading ones in the UK and in the world, and they have a lot of people who are very good at statistics and data analysis, so they gave us a lot of guidance, and we used some of their models, such as we're using their state of living planet index. So it's a living planet, it's a sort of a statistical approach looking at trends in changes in species populations over time, and they produce a report every 2 years with WWF plotting the state of the planet, so changes in time, and it's really seen as one of the key leading global metrics to monitor change in population, species population over time.
Wow.
So they were very instrumental in helping us shape and doing our data analysis as well. But loads of people really helped. You know, we had Centre for Ecology Hydrology, CEH, they were amazing on some of the water quality analysis, and then team experts from the Environment Agency looking at the inverts and again water quality. So yeah, lots of people put a lot of intellectual input into it, and hopefully it's made a robust report for all.
Yeah, how exciting is that? There's so many people involved. That's so good. And like, what were the overall findings then? Do you think it was more positive? Do you think, I personally found it like a good positive spin on it, coming from someone like maybe a lay person perspective. How do you feel about it?
Great. Well, definitely. I think we've come a long way since the 1950s. We can see real improvements in a lot of the water quality, you know, the dissolved oxygen, we can see that. And that's primarily down to investment in infrastructure, so sewage treatment works and things, and also good policy and management being implemented, such as from the Environment Agency looking at industrial inputs into the water, so controlling water temperatures or of release of nutrients of wastewater and things going in. So that really makes a big impact on the water quality. So good trends there, but some work to do still with the nitrates and phosphates. Phosphates improving, but nitrates still very high. And that's again combined with sewage treatment, sewage going in, and also agricultural runoff. So work to do there. We set, a contemporary almost indicator, which has come onto our radar in the last 10 years or so, is obviously the amount of plastics in the river. And, you know, back in the 50s, we probably didn't have.
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
We had plastic, but not so much. It certainly wasn't such an integral part of our daily lives. So
Sure. Setting
an indicator for that, I think, would be really interesting. And one of the details I really enjoyed about that plastics indicator was looking at the amount of, you know, earbuds, you know, the things that, well, I don't think they're called earbuds, but the cotton buds that people stick in their ears
and
clean them. Well, you're not supposed to, and no one do that because it's dangerous for you. But anyway, those cotton buds,
right.
Because they were always made out of plastic, and there was a campaign, but then the policy was put in to turn them into cardboard or anything else. And you can really see the trend in high levels. One of the most common, frequently found item of plastic, single plastic waste in the Thames. And then you could see the policy coming in, or big companies changing their procurement to turn it cardboard, and you can see a real decline in it. So it's a really lovely case of how the evidence can drive policy change that sees impact, and it's captured in the use of these cotton buds over like 3-4 years in that one indicator.
Wow.
So it's really interesting, and I know some of our colleagues in London, Thames 21 particularly, are leading the way to try and stop plastic wet wipes. So it'd be really interesting if that comes through to see, you know, in future years whether you can start seeing the trends in downward trend in that as well. So one of the indicators I was most shocked about, really, and I know we talked the talk about it, but is our climate change indicators. So
yeah, sure.
The sea level rise and water temperatures. And year on year, we're seeing a massive, well, really significant amount of sea level rise being indicated in London. I mean, up to 4.6 millimetres a year, I think, in some locations. And I was quite surprised about the extent of that, I know I listen and we talk about it, but actually seeing it a half a centimetre, near on half a centimetre a year in central London, I think is interesting, just downstream from central London. And then again, similar, looking at water temperatures, we talk about increasing in water temperatures and how that affects wildlife shifting, life patterns and distribution and migration. But we've really seen a very significant increase in water temperatures, particularly linked to summer water temperatures. So they were two indicators that was really quite surprised. I was surprised, but the extent that we're seeing change due to climate change, climate use changed, surprised me how evident and significant it was. But we're, you know, London as always is ahead of the game. We've got a project, Thames Estuary 2100, and that's really future-proofing against sea level rise. And looking for long-term solutions for the next 100 years. So London is leading the way globally on that, which is good news.
So there's been some good and some bad insights in the report, but it seems like there is a lot of hope for the future.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just seeing how, you know, people are turning to face the river and enjoy it. And you can see that in the state of the play by the number of people who access and enjoy it, whether it's for recreation or just for standing next to the river and feeling at peace. I know that's how what I do. I just, you know, the movement of the water makes me feel good and takes away my negative energy. So
yeah, 100%.
You know, it's really that. And so I love the fact that people are turning to face the river. I mean, when it was so bad and so polluted, you can see in the architecture, you know, buildings were turned with their backs to the river rather than facing it, and just the sort of physically, you know, turning to face the river rather than turning away from it shows that people are looking at it. And our job as ZSL and, you know, fellow NGOs, wildlife, is our role now to keep telling people about how important a wildlife habitat it is, and how important, even though it looks brown and mucky, it's not, it's clean and it's thriving with life, and we need to all be stewards of that to let it continue to thrive, because we do have a lot of work to do still.
Yeah, I was actually going to talk to you about the colour of the Thames. I actually did a survey on Instagram where I asked people if they could describe in one word what would they describe the Thames, and a lot of people said dirty. And there's this huge thing that people just think that it's life couldn't be in such a place. But obviously, as we know, there's 13. I don't know if I say this word right. Tributaries.
Yes.
So a lot of that colour, it's just sediment, isn't it? It's actually a really like healthy, hearty place for a massive ecosystem to like thrive on.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, can you just tell me a little bit more about why the Thames is that colour and what it means for the ecosystem that thrives in it? Like what's going on in there? Why is this misinformation of this colour when it's actually really a positive thing?
Yeah. I think, the poor Thames with its brown, being brown, it's suffered. I mean, obviously, there's the historic knowledge about how polluted and devoid of life it was, and probably in quite a few people's living memories. And actually, if you look closely, there is a lot of sewage-derived litter, as they say in there, because a lot of sewage does go in. But the brownness is good, and the brownness is sediment that has come down from the rivers or was in the system from the sea, and it's basically nutrient rich sediment that feeds the whole ecosystem. So that brown sediment contains food for plankton, you know, small crabs and shrimps, and then that in turn is fish food, which then becomes fish food for bigger fish, and ultimately it all goes up the food chain to you know, our top predators, our seals, our porpoises, our sharks that we find in the outer estuary. But it's also really nutrient rich, so the mud comes and settles down in the outer estuary, so in the salt marshes and the seagrasses at beds in the outer estuary, and that is a rich growing ground for vegetation. But also these are the areas that gives us protection for our coastal resilience. So these soft habitats, these muddy habitats, are the areas that will take the brunt of storm damage, the waves crashing on it or whatever, and protects us from flooding and storm. So it's vital that having that sediment in the system or in the water is vital, not only for our food supply but and our nutrients, but also to protect us against storms. So brown is good in this case.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that. And some of the animals you just mentioned, I knew about a few of them, but crabs and shrimps, I had no idea about. That's great. That's so clever. I love that.
Yeah, all
sorts. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Do you get crabs like throughout the whole Thames, or is it just more on the saltier end?
We get more sort of coastal crabs in the outer end, but coming into London we have a lot of Chinese mitten crabs, which actually are non-native species. But yeah,
yeah, so I saw that in the report actually.
Yeah, so they're a non-native species. So yeah, if you all the way up to Teddington, I think if you lift up a rock or look in the burrows, you'll probably be able to find them.
Isn't that
as well
great?
As eels. And you find little eels as well, so that'd
yeah.
be exciting.
I love that. These are just so, like, they're such fun facts, aren't they? I really like, yeah. I enjoy them a lot. So you mentioned sharks, and I know that in the media, sharks have been picked up from this report quite a lot, and not necessarily with a positive spin. And I wanted to hear what you thought about that.
Yeah, I know. They always say whatever, all press is good press or something like that. Anyway, yes, we had to do some mitigation about it, but yeah, it got very much picked up. I think
yeah.
like two words in our press release and it went a bit crazy
yeah.
about the sharks. And yeah, I mean, there's literally one sentence, but yes, we do have a good shark population in the Outer Thames, and we've got five species of sharks, and including smooth hounds and tope and spur dog, which are what people think of when they think about sharks. But yeah, these have lived with us for a long time, and all the fishermen know that they're there. But what's really interesting is most of us, including myself a few years ago, probably weren't aware of the importance of the Thames for them. And we have a project now, it's just in its early days, working with some of the recreational anglers and charter boat fishermen out there to really understand how sharks use the area, and particularly how they use them as a nursery area, so to have their young and their pups. And like everything we're finding out about the Thames, we're really beginning to pick up a picture of how important a nursery area it is, and for all fish species, from from sea bass through to Dover sole through to some of our shark species. But yeah, we're always fighting this. I feel sorry for sharks because they're such amazing creatures, and
yeah.
they get this terrible press, and we could have to thank Jaws for that, I think.
Exactly.
I did a
yeah.
press interview and suddenly I was like, oh, why are they quiet? And then suddenly I heard the duh, duh, duh. I was like, oh, no. Like, sharks are good. They're amazing.
They
they're
are,
not going to help
sharks.
Any. They're not going to, our sharks are not going to hurt anyone.
No
one should be frightened of them. And we should embrace them and love them because they're incredible.
Yeah, I love sharks. They're probably more frightened of us anyway.
Oh, completely. Yeah, we're much more of a dangerous animal than they are.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, it's not very likely that you'd see one in the Thames anyway, but you'd probably be more likely to see seals, right?
Yes, you're probably much more likely to see seals, especially in central London and going west. I mean, right away along the riverbanks, there's opportunities to see them haul out, or them just coming up and swimming under the bridges. They're inquisitive species and inquisitive animals. And actually we have a marine mammal sighting program that's been running years now, and we are getting increased number of sightings further up west into up to Teddington. And whether that's because more people are on the river, or out enjoying it with our lockdown, people are sort of accessing nature locally and so seeing more, or whether more seals are increasing and coming in, look forward to finding that out. But yeah, we've got a growing seal population in the Thames, and yeah, you're likely to see, if you look hard enough, you'll hopefully have opportunity to see them.
That's just wild, isn't it? That's just crazy. So is that a citizen science thing that you mentioned just then?
Yes, it is very much. It's a seal sighting, so we ask for anyone who spots a seal or a porpoise to send us the details of it. It's on our website at zsl.org, and we try and build up a picture and map when and where these seals were sighted. And over a long time, we get sort of patterns of use of where, favourite haul-out sites are or when they're likely to see them. And it just really gives us an understanding. And from that stemmed our annual seal count. So we do a seal population count each year and a seal breeding survey just to get to understand the population dynamics, because we have two seals. We have harbour seals and grey seals, two different well, more than two seals. We have two different species of seal, harbour seal and grey seal.
So there's just two.
Yeah. Hassles if there's only just two of them. But, so building up the picture of how they use the Thames as well.
Is there any other citizen science programs that you rely on for ZSO?
Well, we very much love working with volunteer citizen scientists because it enables us to have much better coverage and resources. As a conservation charity, we're forever fundraising for our projects, and London is quite vast and we're quite few, so we work very closely with citizen science and local community groups to deliver our conservation. And what we feel is really important is if we sort of co-create projects, so we very much identify a challenge, an environmental challenge, and work together to develop it with the regulators, such as the Environment Agency and industry, such as some of the big water companies, perhaps, to co-create and the communities to co-create a solution. And very much how we work with citizen science is for a strong, robust evidence gathering to build the evidence of the challenge. And then from that, we can make good environmental decisions and solutions. So one of the projects we have running is called Outfall Safari, and it's teams of volunteers and citizen scientists walking up the river and mapping where we're seeing pollution going into the rivers from misconnection. And from that, we can then send the report to the Environment Agency, who then check it out, who then can work out how it needs to be remediated. And sometimes that's from plumbing being incorrectly plumbing in new houses, and so then the councils deal with it, or sometimes it's, you know, other runoff. And then we do a lot of water quality monitoring through invertebrate analysis as well. So that's looking at the animals that live in the river. It gives us a good indication of the health of it. So
sure,
we have teams of volunteers around London looking at that each month, doing a river monitoring initiative. So looking at what's living in the river to tell us the health of it. So it creates like an early warning system that we can look for pollution, and we look for changes, long-term changes as well.
That's great. So you get like a really big sense of a community from London in order to make actions with the Thames. And it's really nice that you can have volunteers and communities do that, and they can see that they're getting a lot of benefit from it as well.
Carry on.
There was something I just picked up there, and I spoke to my friend about this, and I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, please. You know, you can get things like oysters that they clean some of the water, is that right?
Yes.
Can you get any insight using them to know what's going on with the pollution? I don't know if I'm phrasing that right at all. Do you know what I mean?
They for chemical analysis, I think, of sediments or water quality, that you can use. Well, I think people take samples of some species have to do an analysis of tissues and materials, but obviously that's quite a destructive way of doing it, because you have to kill the animals to do that. Rather than using sensors and monitors. But as part of, I think if you're doing sediment quality analysis, you'll do your biological oxygen demand and your chemical oxygen demand, you'll do sediment breakdowns, but you'll also do, half-life things. Anyway, I count fish. I can eat. You better off as well, or that.
Well, that's an interesting answer. I didn't think of it ethically, so that's quite an interesting insight.
Yeah, so you can do that. But the data that we use, as often we either collect water quality samples and send them off to the laboratory, or there's real-time monitoring going on through using SONS, like water quality meters. There's the Environment Agency has like long-term continuous water quality monitoring in the system. So there's a lot of information you can do without using animals as well.
That's good. Okay, cool. That's good to know. I've got some more questions from the public that I'd like to ask you.
Oh gosh, where do you get them from?
I got my secret stash. One of them was simply, can you swim in the Thames? And I know that there's a current.
Yeah, really fast flowing water, yeah.
I suppose it would be in a more sense if you were doing paddle boarding and you fell in the water. Is that going to be an issue?
I go paddle boarding on the Thames. I go swimming in the Thames.
Nice.
But everyone needs to be careful. It is very dangerous currents and all the rest of it. So don't listen to me, do your own risk assessments. I do a rapid risk assessment every time I go out looking for health and safety reasons. So be careful. I go in. I don't go in after it's rained, though. I might paddleboard after it's rained. You're likely to have sewage going in, and I tend to avoid putting my children in or myself in for a few days after that.
Okay.
And invariably, or if I do it, you just keep your head out. And then we always wash our hands afterwards. You must always wash your hands because there is sewage. But I do go in, and I do find great pleasure in paddleboarding and swimming in the river.
Oh, that's amazing. You go swimming in there as well?
Yeah. Well, I live up in Oxfordshire now, so it's a bit more benign. But
Okay.
But yeah, we do go swimming.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So just maybe avoid it after a few days after it's rained.
Yeah. Well, that's what we do. But anyway.
Yeah.
Everyone be careful. And people do get ill. And people, yeah. Anyway, don't go on my endorsement, please. Thank you very much.
That's good to know. I got another question was, how does the Thames get cleaner? So I suppose, what if there is sewage that spills in from the rain, how does the Thames clean itself? Or is there measures that we have as humans that clean it?
Yeah, so our environmental systems are robust and resilient, but what we need to give them is space and time to repair themselves. It's when we are massively put pressures on them to the point that they collapse. It doesn't work anymore. So we've got antiquated infrastructure in most urban settings. We haven't had the investment in repairing and or investing in infrastructure being sewage treatment works or sewage systems. And we've got an increased load of people living in London and all around our tributaries and the rivers. And that causes an awful lot more waste. We're also much more water demanding, you know, with all our washing machines. Everyone's got washing machines. Everyone's washing their clothes every time they wear it. And so we have, as a collectively, put a massive increased burden on our infrastructure. And we haven't invested in it to make it fit for purpose for that number. So the rivers are now receiving the brunt of that because we have licensed discharge going in, but we also have unlicensed discharge going in, and that is really affecting the quality of the rivers. So what we need is better regulation. We need better investment in regulating. You know, the regulators have had their budgets slashed by well over 50%. They're completely under capacity and resource. The onus is put on to the water users to self-regulate, but I mean, I know I self-regulate my alcohol units per week, and that doesn't work. And so we need massive investment in infrastructure. So we need to do an awful lot to, you know, enable our rivers to recover. But they are resilient. The environment is resilient. Nature is resilient. And if you let it and have the space and time to do so, it will recover. And we've seen that. We've gone from being dead, you know, in the 50s to, you know, full of life again. So you can see how it works, and that has come from investment in infrastructure and better policy. So we've got precedent of how it works. We just need to apply it again and get the rivers back, you know, give them a chance again to recover.
That's amazing. Really hopeful. I love that. That was really good. Yeah, thank you. Does it work at all with the tides at all, or does it help if there is a sewage spill? Does the tides maybe like bring it back out into the sea? Does that work at all?
Yeah, you do get mixing, and yeah, the big volume of water will flush out eventually and dilute the pollution going in, but it won't all go out in one big go. If you think about, I don't know, if you see a branch floating on the top of the water in the river, you know, it'll go up one way with the tide and it'll go down again and it keeps going. So it'll take, you know, days for that stick to get out to sea.
Sure, sure.
And, or, you know, if it's plastic bottle, it might sink to the bottom, might never go out to sea as part of it. And so you do get a flushing, you do get a dilution, but it's not out in one go. There's a long residence time in the estuary itself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Well, zooming back into the report, when is the next one? Did you say in 2 years' time?
Oh, yeah. We've got to get funding.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly. Anyone got full pockets?
Yeah.
We would like to do it every, you know, it's a big piece of work. So we would like to do it every 3 or 4 years or so, every 3 years. But yeah, we would need to secure funding to do that.
And were there any lessons learned, and what would you change for the future one?
I think one of the key lessons learned is, about data management and data storage and data cleaning. We're collecting a lot of data by all our monitoring, but, you know, it's often stored in different places and no one has the time or capacity to analyze it or look at these trends. And, you know, we've worked hard to get funding to do that, but there isn't the resources to be able to look at what we're monitoring and what the impact and implications of what we're monitoring is, rather than a snapshot of that current moment. So I'd really love it that data are more available for people to use, and hopefully, you know, we can do that with the State of Thames. And I would like for people to have the time and headspace to actually look at it, because then we can start making informed decisions about how we need to, or where we need to invest our infrastructure, where we need to look at changing practice and policy, and we can communicate to people why we need to do that, and we can give the evidence why we need to do that, you know, and then we can start seeing change, you know, just like the, going back to the cotton buds, you know, there's a problem. It's number one plastic in the river. Let's change policy and turn them into cardboard. And there you go. Look, now we don't see hardly any, because there's paper and not plastic. And so you can see real change if you understand why and you've got the evidence. So having the space and the money and the time to collect that information and let people analyze it and communicate it, I think would be really beneficial for all.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that key word there is communication. I was having a ponder about this earlier, and I'm not sure of the exact stat, but I know that a lot of children that live in London, they've never actually seen the Thames, and they're just, they're not aware of it. And of course, there's this negative perspective on it, that it does float around because of just like simply the colour of it. And so I was thinking, in schools, maybe they could try to implement in the syllabus, I don't know, yeah, you could say for the UK, but I suppose it wouldn't just be London as well, but maybe they should try to push in schools at a younger age that there is this like living river with all these like fabulous things going on about it. But maybe people need to know like at a younger age so that they can learn and engage and begin to love it and appreciate it, you know, like look after it.
Yeah, I guess I think that's sort of all our responsibility, as well as the teachers. You know, teachers are so put upon, you know, if we can start talking about, you know, it's a clean air corridor, the Thames. You know, if you look at the air quality in London, you get this lovely, I don't know what colour it comes up, blue clear stripe, you know, going down the river. And, you know, the cleanest air quality you'll get is standing next to the Thames. So there's so many benefits for going to visit or just sit next to it. But obviously, you know, you have to make a purposeful visit, you know, if you're living in the middle of South London or something. There are a lot of benefits, but perhaps maybe we all just start talking about it and start bringing it up, for then, you know, children will get that, as well as, you know, the informal education as well as the formal educational routes.
Yeah, that's very true. That's really true. I had no idea about the air quality. If you're close to the Thames, it's more improved.
Yes, it's good air quality right in the centre. Yeah, you need to talk to the Port of London Authority. They've been doing a lot of work on that. So maybe your next podcast, you can get them to talk about it.
How interesting. Okay. Yeah, because I know that London's got its own mini climate because of the Thames. Oh, great. Oh, very interesting. One of my last questions for you is, again, to do more of the public. And what can the public do to learn more about the Thames, and what can the public do to improve the Thames?
Well, to learn more about it, I think, like you're saying, there's nothing better than to go and try and visit it, or just stand on the bridge, or sit on, you know, the South Bank, or out in, you know, in the wilds of Kent. You can get down to the river. I guess there are some parks along it that are, probably feel like safe spaces if you want. And of course, you've got the Thames Path that you can walk along past it. So, no, it's nothing worth more than, you know, a million words, is to go and actually feel it and smell it and see it. There's also lots of other opportunities. There's lots of like educational groups along the river, like the Thames Explorer Trust, that do some amazing work working with school children and adults, giving learning opportunities to learn about our wildlife and about the environment, Thames ecology. So I know there's certainly one in Deptford, and there's one in Chiswick, and elsewhere. So these are great places that you can learn about the environment, either through schools or just they probably do courses or family days on, you know, or days on the river. And there's also, you know, good events going on in the Mayor's Thames Festival. I mean, it's much more arts and cultural, but you get the heritage richness. You learn more about the heritage, and because it's not just, I guess, the environment, the Thames, it's, you know, it's our heritage as well, with the sailing and the fishing and so forth. So there's so much other richnesses to learn about it. So I just love, like we were saying earlier, I just want everyone to turn and face it rather than turn away from it and get to enjoy it, feel proud of it. People should feel proud of it.
That's great. I really love that. Yeah. I think that's a really good takeaway message, actually. We should feel proud of it. I think that's a really good word to use. Yeah. Amazing. Well, Alison, is there anything else that you'd like to mention before we say bye-bye?
No, I think that's it. Really nice. Yeah. People should think about it and smile and feel proud.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem. All right. Cheers, Chloe.
You've now reached the end of this Talk of the Thames episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and a big thank you to you for tuning in. For updates of what we're up to at the Thames Estuary Partnership, you can visit our website on www.thamesestuarypartnership.org and find us on our socials, which are linked in this episode's show notes. This episode has been brought to you by me, Chloe Russell, on behalf of Thames Estuary Partnership, and I look forward to greeting you next time.